Hello and welcome to this Expert HR podcast with me, Laura Merrilees. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Jo Broadbent, counsel and professional support lawyer at Hogan Lovells and contributing author to Expert HR, to discuss the tricky issue of the interaction of maternity rights and redundancy. It's an area of the law that can, in practice, be fraught with mistakes and assumptions, and the implications of getting it wrong can not only be costly, but reputationally damaging. Well, we're here today to remind you of what the law says, and crucially, how to apply it in practice. Jo, if we can kick off, please, with a pretty fundamental question, but one that can nevertheless be misunderstood. Can you select a woman who is pregnant for redundancy?
Yes, in principle, there's absolutely no reason why someone who's pregnant can't be selected for redundancy. Now, that's obviously subject to a couple of caveats.
Yeah.
One is that clearly there needs to be a genuine redundancy situation. And secondly, an employer will need to be able to show that the reason that the woman has been selected is nothing to do with her pregnancy or the fact that she's going to be taking maternity leave. And if those factors are taken into account in selecting her for dismissal, then clearly the redundancy could be automatically unfair and could also amount to pregnancy and maternity discrimination.
Okay, so if we then compare that with the situation of the position of someone who is absent on maternity leave, what's the position there?
Yeah, again, the position is very similar to that of someone who's pregnant. At the moment, no reason why somebody who's on maternity leave can't be selected for redundancy, subject to there being a genuine redundancy situation and to the woman not being selected for one of the prohibited reasons. I think the other thing it's important for employers to think about if you're selecting somebody who's on maternity leave is the need to make sure that they're included as part of any individual or collective consultation process. Sometimes it can be a case of out of sight, out of mind, somebody on maternity leave gets forgotten, or the employer doesn't want to interrupt the maternity leave period. And in that case, if you forget to involve that person in the consultation, again, you've got potentially a pregnancy and maternity discrimination claim on your hands.
Yeah, so there are administrative sort of concerns around that.
Exactly.
You make sure that, as you say, people aren't sort of lost in the process.
That's right.
And they are contacted. So do employers have to be careful about their selection criteria?
Yes, they do. As we've said, selecting for somebody for pregnancy or maternity leave related reasons is automatically unfair and discriminatory. But employers also need to be careful to ensure that selection criteria that are on the face of it neutral don't inadvertently discriminate against somebody because of their pregnancy or maternity leave. So, for example, one factor that is often taken into account in redundancy selection exercises is performance criteria. And if there's a suggestion that somebody's performance has been adversely impacted by the fact that she's pregnant, taking a low performance rating into account could give rise to a pregnancy discrimination claim. Similarly, it may be problematic to rely on an older performance criteria where the employee hasn't had a chance to have a more recent performance assessment because she's on maternity leave, for example. And in that sort of situation, what employers sometimes try and do is carry out some sort of mini appraisal before the employee goes on maternity leave to ensure that they've got up-to-date information to base any decisions on, should they need to do so. I think another issue that comes up is sickness absence rates. Again, sickness absence is often one of the criteria taken into account as part of any selection exercise. And if a woman has had absences because of pregnancy-related illnesses, those clearly need to be discounted from any process and the selection criteria in order to ensure that you're not treating her unfavourably because of her pregnancy.
Yeah. Now, this is something which comes up from time to time. You do see it being argued. A man who is at work, can he argue that it is sex discrimination if selection criteria are adjusted for a woman on maternity leave?
Yes. Normally, what employers are concerned about is making sure that they're not treating somebody on maternity leave unfavourably because of it. So what they want to do is make sure that that employee is being protected. However, there is one case in particular that shows that there are risks associated with going too far in the other direction. And there was a case called Eversheds Legal Services and DeBellin. There was a redundancy process affecting a man at work and his colleague who was on maternity leave, and one of the selection criteria that the employer wanted to take into account was what they referred to as the lock-up period, and that was basically how quickly somebody got paid after they had done a particular piece of work. And because the reference period they were using included part of the period while the woman had been on maternity leave, they didn't have proper figures for her that enabled them to compare the two positions. So what they did was just give her the highest possible rating that they could have given her under that score. They gave her the maximum maximum score in that criteria. Yeah. And what that meant was that it was actually her male colleague who was still at work who was selected for redundancy. He challenged the decision to dismiss him as sex discrimination, and he in fact won his case, which at the time was seen as slightly surprising. And what the EAT said in that decision was that although employers are entitled to give women special treatment to ensure that they're not disadvantaged by pregnancy or maternity leave, yeah, that treatment has got to be proportionate. And in this case, what the employer had done was not proportionate, because there were other ways they could have treated both employees fairly without giving such a degree of preferential treatment to the woman. So, for example, they could have used a period to calculate the lockup rate while both employees were at work, and that would have meant that she didn't get the super treatment, the maximum points treatment. And in that situation, he might not have been selected for redundancy. And I think what that illustrates is the need for employers to be careful not to go too far in their attempts not to discriminate against employees who are on maternity leave.
Yeah, so to take that step back and apply your mind and look at potentially if there's any unfairness that could be caused to others as well. So
exactly.
It's getting the balance right.
And then think about what you could do to address that unfairness. Is there a more proportionate way to achieve both objectives?
So, if a woman is selected for redundancy while she's pregnant, does she have any special rights during that time?
No. Generally, someone who's selected for redundancy while she's pregnant doesn't have any special rights over and above other employees. There are just two things for the employer to think about. One is the fact that somebody who's dismissed while they're pregnant has got the right to receive a written statement which sets out the reasons for that dismissal without having to request it. Normally, employees would need to make a request in order to get a written statement of reasons for dismissal. A pregnant woman doesn't have to. And also she doesn't need to show that she's got 2 years service, which again, normally you would need to have a written statement of reasons for dismissal. The second thing the employer needs to do is consider whether or not she's already qualified for statutory maternity pay.
Right, okay, and we'll be coming on to that a little bit later in our conversation. What about the situation where someone on maternity leave is selected for redundancy? Any special rights that arise during that period?
Yes, in contrast with somebody who's dismissed while they're pregnant, somebody who's dismissed for redundancy while she's on maternity leave has got an enhanced degree of protection. And those employees are entitled to be offered a suitable alternative vacancy, either with the employer or with an associated employer, before their existing contract comes to an end. So effectively, that amounts to a priority right to redeployment, meaning that if there is a suitable alternative vacancy, it's got to be offered to somebody who's on maternity leave in preference to other employees, even if those other employees might in fact be better qualified for the role than she is.
Yeah, and again, that's something that can be misunderstood, I think, by employers in practice. And a point that can cause confusion is, what point is the duty to offer a suitable alternative vacancy triggered?
Yes, I think employers sometimes struggle to identify this. And there was a recent EAT decision that gave some quite helpful guidance on the point. And what that decision said is that the duty arises at the point at which it's clear that the employee's role is redundant or is likely to become redundant, is at risk of redundancy, as we would refer to it. And that case, which is called Sefton Borough Council and Wainwright, involved a restructuring where two senior roles were being amalgamated into one. Mrs. Wainwright, who held one of those roles, was at maternity at the point at which the restructuring was implemented. She was invited to apply an interview for the new role, but wasn't in fact offered it. She was subsequently dismissed for redundancy, and she claimed that her dismissal was automatically unfair because she hadn't been offered a suitable vacancy, which this new post would have been. What the employer tried to say was that she was redundant only at the point at which it became clear that she wasn't going to get the new, more senior role in the restructured organisation. And the EAT dismissed that argument. They said that it would undermine the purposes of giving a woman a right to priority redeployment if the restructure, in fact, had to be completed before the duty to offer suitable alternative employment, in fact, arose. However, just because the new position would have been suitable for her didn't necessarily mean that it had to be offered to her. If there had been another role within the restructure that was suitable for her and she had been offered that role, the employer would have complied with its duty to offer suitable alternative employment, even though that sort of the job that you might have thought of immediately as being suitable hadn't in fact been offered to her.
Yeah. Okay, so when we're looking at suitable alternative vacancies, what amounts to a suitable alternative vacancy?
There are really two things that the employer's got to watch out for here in deciding whether or not a vacancy is suitable. The first is that the work has got to be suitable and appropriate for the employee in question. And the second thing to look out for is in relation to the provisions relating to the place of employment and the terms and conditions attaching to the new job. These have got to be not substantially less favourable to the employee than was the case under her original contract. And there was a case fairly recently looking at what that might mean in practice. It was called Simpson and Ensley Insurance Services, and it involved a situation in which the employee's place of work in London closed while she was on maternity leave. The work was transferred to various call centres, including some in Cheltenham, and all the employees who were being dismissed were said that if they wanted to go and work at one of these other call centres, they were entitled to do so. The employee, for various reasons, didn't express any interest in doing that and was therefore made redundant. She then claimed that her dismissal was automatically unfair because one of the Cheltenham jobs was effectively what she was doing already. It therefore would have been suitable alternative employment for her and she should have been offered it. Neither the tribunal nor the EAT upheld her complaint, and they said, okay, it might be the case that the content of the job in Cheltenham would have been suitable for you, but the employer is entitled to look at the situation in the round. Given that the place of work was clearly substantially less favourable to you than under your previous contract of employment, that meant that the roles in Cheltenham were not suitable alternative vacancies, and therefore the employer had not automatically unfairly dismissed you by making you redundant without having offered you those jobs.
Do any other types of employees have the right to priority redeployment, as we've just been discussing, for those on maternity leave? Does that apply to others that might be in different circumstances?
Yes, it does. It applies to two other groups of employees who might be on extended sort of family-related leave. Firstly, somebody who's on adoption leave, and then secondly, somebody who's on shared parental leave. Those employees also enjoy the priority right to redeployment.
Okay, and I think a question that's immediately going to come to mind there: how do you handle a situation where there are a number of different employees with rights to priority redeployment?
That's a really difficult issue, I think, for employers, and there really isn't a clear-cut answer as to how you should deal with it. I think the decision in Sefton Borough Council and Wainwright that we've talked about is helpful in that regard, because it makes it clear that failing to offer a specific suitable alternative vacancy doesn't necessarily make a dismissal automatically unfair.
Yeah.
If there's another role that is also a suitable vacancy which is offered to the individual, and I think employers are going to look at that quite carefully.
Yes.
Just from a practical point of view, it's fortunately relatively uncommon to find a situation where you've got a number of people on extended family leave all being made redundant at the same time. So in practice, the issue doesn't come up as much as one might think.
Now, are there any risks if an employer realises during a period of a woman's maternity leave that it can manage without a particular post, and in fact it's that period of maternity leave which is highlighted perhaps that a role has become obsolete, as it were?
Yes, I think it's not uncommon for employers to find themselves in a situation where it's during a period of maternity leave that they realise that they can manage with fewer employees, and quite often then it is the temptation to make the woman who's on maternity leave redundant. There is a real risk, I think, that dismissing someone in those circumstances will be pregnancy or maternity discrimination and automatically unfair. Having said that, there was a relatively recent EAT decision called SG Petch Limited in English Stewart that found that a dismissal in those circumstances did not amount to pregnancy or maternity discrimination, simply because it was the employee's absence on maternity leave that allowed the employer to identify the potential redundancy situation. What the EAT said is, well, the reason for the dismissal was still redundancy, therefore it couldn't be maternity leave, and therefore the dismissal didn't amount to pregnancy or maternity discrimination. Whether the dismissal was automatically unfair would depend upon whether or not there were other employees holding the same or similar positions to the employee who was made redundant who hadn't been dismissed. And although on the face of it that decision is helpful to employers, I think I would be very cautious before placing too much weight on it. One thing that the decision didn't deal with was whether it was the fact of the employee's maternity leave and her absence on maternity leave that resulted in her being the one that was selected.
Yeah.
And if that was in fact the reason why she was selected, then I think the dismissal could have been pregnancy or sex discrimination, maternity discrimination, notwithstanding the fact that the identification of the redundancy during the maternity leave, the EAT found, wasn't itself pregnancy or maternity discrimination.
Yeah, I think, as you say, it needs to be treated with caution because it is a particularly difficult area perhaps to get right.
And I think we'd see see that as a bit of an outlier, perhaps. Yes.
So just turning now to notice periods, what happens to an employee's notice period if she is dismissed while she's on maternity leave?
Well, I think the starting point is that somebody who's dismissed while she's on maternity leave is entitled to be given notice in exactly the same way as any other employee. The more fundamental question is what pay the employee is going to be entitled to receive during that notice period, and that's going to depend upon what the length of her notice period is. So if somebody's entitled to the statutory notice period, she's then entitled to receive a week's pay for each week of her notice period. And what that probably means is that she's going to be entitled to receive more than she's receiving by way of SMP. She's entitled to have her notice pay topped up to her normal rate of pay. The position is different for a woman whose notice period is at least 1 week more than the statutory minimum. That enhanced level of protection doesn't apply to her, which means that during any period of notice while she's on maternity leave, what she'll be entitled to receive will reflect what she would have been receiving had she not been under notice. In other words, her statutory maternity pay and potentially contractual maternity pay, if applicable.
Yeah, so it's quite a technical point that
it's very technical.
Yeah, exactly. Employers need to sort of look at in detail before they start embarking on what to pay. You know,
exactly. Somewhere.
Moving on to maternity pay, what happens to maternity pay if someone is made redundant before her maternity leave?
In that situation, the employer's got to consider whether or not she's entitled to statutory maternity pay regardless of the fact that she's been dismissed. And that's going to depend on whether or not she's still an employee at the qualifying week, which is the end of the 15th week before the expected week of childbirth. And basically, if the employee has reached that point and has met the other qualifying conditions, she's still going to qualify for SMP regardless of the fact that she's subsequently made redundant.
And what about someone who is dismissed while she is on maternity leave?
It's going to be a very similar position. As with somebody who's pregnant, who's qualified for SMP, somebody who's dismissed while she's on maternity leave and receiving SMP is going to be entitled to continue to receive that SMP until the end of her SMP period, or if sooner, until she starts a new job. Employers may choose to make that payment as a lump sum. That may be administratively easier, although again, there may be some national insurance contribution implications to doing that. There may also be a problem with overpaying SMP if it subsequently transpires that the SMP period actually ended earlier, for example, because the employee has taken up a new job. In both cases, it will be quite uncommon for company maternity pay to continue after the point of termination, regardless of whether or not that's a pregnant employee who's dismissed or somebody who's on maternity leave.
Again, so another technical point that shouldn't be overlooked. They all come into play in practice and employers need to be familiar with them.
Yeah, I should also just say that if somebody's dismissed before that qualifying week, typically she wouldn't then be entitled to SMP, and in any event, normally an employee's contractual maternity pay, enhanced maternity pay, will come to an end at the point of dismissal, regardless of when that occurs.
Looking then at discretionary termination payments and an employer who may want to wrap statutory maternity pay into a discretionary termination payment, are there any points that an employer needs to look out for there?
Quite often what an employer wants to do in that situation is pay an employee's statutory maternity pay entitlement as a lump sum. If they're making an enhanced redundancy payment, they will quite often then say, well, we'll just wrap that lump sum payment up with your statutory maternity pay entitlement. Employers need to be slightly careful about how they document any such arrangement, if that is what they want to do. And the reason for that is a recent decision called Campus Living Villages UK against the HMRC, which really highlighted the issue. Now, in that case, an employee was made redundant before she qualified for SMP, but before her baby was born. She brought claims for unfair dismissal and pregnancy discrimination, and those were settled following ACAS conciliation using a COT 3 agreement. And the employer agreed to pay the employee £60,000 in compensation, and that was expressed to be in full and final settlement of all her claims. But apart from £20,000, which was attributed to an injury to feelings payment, the rest of that payment wasn't itemised. So the employee subsequently complained that the employer had failed to pay her the statutory maternity pay to which she was entitled, and HMRC upheld that decision and ordered the employer to pay approximately £42,000 in SMP to the employee. And the reason that that figure was so high was because she had been paid quite a significant bonus during the period for which her average earnings for SNP purposes were calculated. So obviously that was higher than you might normally have expected. The employer tried to say, well, the COT3 agreement was in full and final settlement of all claims, therefore the statutory maternity pay claim falls away as well. And the first tier tax tribunal pointed out that agreements that purport to exclude the right to SNP are in fact void, so the employee wasn't in a position to sign away her rights. And even if the payment that had been made to the employee included an element in respect of her maternity rights, it didn't include her entitlement to SNP. The tax tribunal pointed out that national insurance contributions weren't paid on any part of that termination payment, as they would have been had some of it been attributable to statutory maternity pay. And on that basis, the COT3 agreement didn't exclude the employee's right to SNP. And the message for employers from that decision is that if SNP entitlement is going to be satisfied by payment of a lump sum, it's very important to make sure that the amount of any payment that's attributable to SNP is very clearly specified in any settlement agreement or any COT3 agreement.
Yeah.
And also it's going to be important to make sure that the appropriate tax treatment of any part of the sum that's attributable to SNP is applied correctly.
Yeah, okay, so broad brush, let's wrap it all up in one agreement isn't going to work.
Right, and you're potentially then on the hook for paying the SNP twice.
Okay, so sort of looking at this area more generally, are there any potential changes employers should be aware of on the horizon?
There's one particular matter that employers should be thinking about, and this stems from the fact that much of the UK's protection for women on maternity leave or who are pregnant stems from the European Pregnant Workers Directive. And there's been a recent Advocate General's opinion on the Pregnant Workers Directive that may extend the maternity-related protection currently available to women in a redundancy situation. And the case was called Porres Guisado and Bankia SA. Pretty standard situation. There was a collective redundancy exercise going on, and somebody who was pregnant was selected for redundancy as part of that exercise. Under the Pregnant Workers Directive, a woman can only be dismissed during pregnancy or maternity leave for exceptional cases not connected with their condition. And there were two things that the employer tried to argue. The first was that it didn't know that she was pregnant, and therefore that additional enhanced protection didn't apply. And the Advocate General's view was that it didn't actually matter whether either the employer or in fact the employee knew that she was pregnant at the point of dismissal. What the Pregnant Workers Directive includes is an absolute prohibition on dismissing an employee while she is pregnant or on maternity leave, except in exceptional circumstances. And that protection doesn't, in fact, depend on either party knowing that the employee is pregnant. The second issue that the Advocate General had to address was whether or not a collective redundancy situation amounted to the sort of exceptional case in which it would be justified to dismiss someone while she was pregnant or on maternity leave. The Advocate General here concluded that it's not necessarily the case that a collective redundancy situation is an exceptional case. She pointed out that collective redundancies occur sufficiently frequently for them not automatically to be viewed as exceptional. And while, for example, a complete business shutdown on one hand might be viewed as exceptional, a more standard situation where a smaller number of employees is being dismissed might not necessarily amount to something that is exceptional. And whether or not it is exceptional is going to be a matter for the National Court to decide. And I think what that opinion tells us that if it is in fact followed by the decision of the full European Court of Justice, it may become more difficult for an employer to dismiss an employee who is pregnant or on maternity leave for redundancy. But we've really got to watch that space, await developments on that front.
Yeah, so you're saying there that the Advocate General's opinion envisages that it would apply even if the employer didn't know that the employee was pregnant, you know, which I think people may well find surprising. How would that work in practice, though? I mean, how could you actually operate on that basis?
I think that is going to be a real practical difficulty for employers if the Advocate General's opinion is in fact adopted in the final decision of the court. What the Advocate General seemed to envisage was that if an employer dismisses an employee and is then told at a later date, no, actually, I was pregnant, then it would have an opportunity to reopen the dismissal decision and reinstate her if, in fact, there was no exceptional reason for the dismissal in the first place. The Advocate General says that the employee shouldn't delay unreasonably in informing the employer of her pregnancy in that situation, but then also seems to suggest that the long stop date could, in fact, be the end of the maternity leave period, which, you know, could potentially be a very long period of time. I mean, I think in practice, it seems very unlikely that an employee would want to wait for that period before going back to her employer and saying, well, actually, you weren't entitled to dismiss me in the first place. But you certainly could envisage a situation where the employee only finds out that she's pregnant once the dismissal has taken place and approaches the employee at that point to ask for reinstatement. I think it just remains to be seen what approach the ECJ is likely to take and then how UK law is going to be adapted if the ultimate decision does in fact reflect the Advocate General's opinion.
Well, thanks very much, Joe. I mean, we have plenty of resources on the site on maternity and redundancy, including a how-to guide on how to deal with pregnant employees and those on maternity leave in a redundancy situation. We also have numerous FAQs, policies and documents, and to delve deeper on maternity rights, do take a look at the maternity leave section of the Employment Law Manual. Well, that brings us to the end of this Expert HR podcast. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next time.